Attention, please. Places for top of show. Places for top of show. Hello, and welcome to Twins Talk Theater. We are Cindy.
And Stacy.
And we're talking about theater, backstage life, and all the excitement that the audience doesn't get to see.
Enjoy the show! Welcome to Andy Lowe Podcast number 2. This is a continuation from last week. So if this is the first one you're listening to, you'll probably be a little confused. Go back and listen to last week's podcast. Hope you enjoy.
I have a question for you that we actually asked Cara, who's a director friend of mine. We talked to her a lot about, it's just a very similar conversation because there's not a lot of female directors, especially in the opera world. And so we had this whole conversation about that. So how has it been for, I mean, you've mentioned this a little bit, but do you bring, as a Asian American director, do you bring like a different viewpoint when you direct? Like, what are the advantages and disadvantages?
I think
who you are coming to directing.
Well, you know, I mean, it's tricky, right? I mean, because my viewpoint on the world is inherently diverse, right?
Mm-hmm.
My childhood is as much informed by, you know, growing up watching Family Ties as it is with, you know, annual Chinese New Year celebrations, right? So there's certainly things where like that's going to sneak its way. I remember years ago, I had a frustrating conversation with a friend of mine, and it was just a chiding joke. And it was like, you know, he had come and seen a show that I had directed, and it was like, oh, Andy's got to make everything Asian. It's like, no, I didn't make everything Asian. I just added a puppet. But I had...
but that's Asian.
But I thought about it. I'm like, well, you know, like, yeah, a lot of my aesthetic, you know, it's like... I love shadow puppets. Shadow puppets are fascinating to me. And the idea of shadows and the iconicness of it, it kind of marries a lot of my loves. Comic book art, because it's an iconic image, because it's not the shadow of a person, it's a shadow of an image that we've created, right?
Yeah, usually they're not people, they're
right.
A person with a really big nose, this is obviously a witch,
even if it's a silhouette that you have cut out from a shadow of someone, it's still a representation of a person. It's not so to me, like there's elements of comic book art to that, of how you're framing this body in space, or this representation of body in space. Then there's the lighting designer that is fascinated with how shadow and light and the whole, and then there's the philosopher in me that kind of brings it back to the allegory of the cave, right? Of do you see, when you look at the shadow, do you see yourself, or do you see the monster that you think is behind you, right? And that juxtaposition. And then there's the influence of, you know, Chinese shadow puppetry, which I did train in. And then there's the Balinese shadow puppet training that I did. So I can't necessarily say it's not Asian, but I can't say that it's because I'm Asian, right? It could be as much because I was, you know, studied lighting design. It could be as much because I studied Greek philosophy. It could be, you know, so that's kind of my roundabout answer.
How many people would go to a show and be like, oh God, there's another white guy directing a show again? You know,
right.
doesn't come up.
This story's going to be more white, heavy males. Mm-hmm. Man, they're right. Going to rule the world.
But it's still the thing, right? You know, we're like, you know, talking about female directors, right? Just going from watching Patty Jenkins' Wonder Woman to Zack Snyder and Joss Whedon's camera work, working with cinematographers, shooting Gal Gadot, right? And how Gal Gadot is shot in Wonder Woman. And you see point, counterpoint, shots with the conversation with her and Chris Pine. And you compare that to a similar scene where Wonder Woman is talking to Batfleck, and it's over the shoulder shot from Batman, and it's behind the butt shot for Gal Gadot, right? Or you know, Gal Gadot walking through the alley looking for a Cyborg, and all of her shots are full body shots with low angle,
right?
Which you don't have a lot of low angle shots because it's not trying to feature her body and her legs.
Right, that's not what it's about.
And so there's, and it's like, it's not even something that I think Zack Snyder thinks about, right? It's just, that's how he's mm-hmm. wired of what he's seeing in the frame, right? So it is, there's a perspective there, and it's subtle, but it makes a difference, right?
Yeah, things I don't even think about, but yeah, they were very different movies showing very different, of the same character, the same actress, in the same world.
Yeah.
We gave the example too in opera, and I don't know how well you know opera, but a male director's perspective of La Boheme or Carmen is completely different than a female's perspective of Boheme and Carmen. Because women would tend to focus on the relationship or the feelings behind it. So they're just two completely different shows,
yeah.
You know, and Boheme and Carmen are so iconic that it's, you know, we just had a big discussion about that. So it just, what made me think about it was when you were talking about, what's the show? Streetcar Named Desire. Mm. You know, when you think about it as all pretty much white characters, Southern Belle, period. As opposed to doing it in a modern time or with different colored performers, or even maybe a female directing it or an African-American directing it versus just a white male, it would be a completely different show, even though you have the exact same words. Well, so,
and this is one of the things, like, this is always a kind of a thorn in my side. It's like, you know, a lot of well-meaning people, progressive, Caucasian people or people of color, who kind of like have this dream of colorblind casting, or what they refer to as colorblind casting, right?
Yeah.
And
I honestly
hate the phrase because it's impossible, right? But it's kind of the thing where you have to be conscious of color, right? I mean, you know, the rule one of storytellers, know your audience, right? Knowing your audience means understanding the cultural context that we all live in. The cultural context is we are a nation that was built on slavery. And when slavery stopped happening, we exploited immigrant workers.
Mm-hmm.
That is our context. We can't deny that. It's not a moral judgment, but that's the context in which our country lives. And all of us here live in that, right? So, and that colors everything. That colors everything. So, you know, so the power dynamics when you have, you know, a scene that was written for a man and a woman, and how that changes when the woman is African-American and the man is white, right? I haven't even mentioned the play, but immediately your brain is going to color that scene with like, well, what is the type power dynamic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is different, just male and female, but now it's white and black.
Right, right. Or, two men in a mammoth play. What if one of them is an Asian male, right? Where does our brain automatically wire us to what that power dynamic is, right? Do we automatically go, oh, well, the Asian character is playing the more dominant mammoth character, and that's a juxtaposition because you don't expect him to be, you know, it's like we have these biases, and you just have to accept that, you know, the Avenue Q thing is great. We're all a little bit racist.
Exactly.
And if we accept that, we're gonna get along better.
Yeah.
Right? And understand that, you know, that's how we tell stories, is understanding kind of our bias. You know, I mean, this is an interesting thing I'm often aware of. At East West Players, because, take into account like just our allegiance team, our TD is female,
mm-hmm.
Our lighting designer is female,
mm-hmm. sound designer is female,
set designer is male,
costumer is female, projection designer is male,
company manager is female. I mean, honestly, actually, just like even like the core team, my core support team, like the people I'm surrounded with are female, like, you know, or even just my in regular East West Players productions, like my master electrician is female, my regular master carpenter is male, but I mean, so and I think I'm always very conscious about making sure that I have perspectives that I'm not going to think about, because I know I have privilege and it's like I'm going to get it wrong. It's just inherent to, you know, growing up with privilege, right? Which is why I'm dependent on, you know, keeping these voices diverse around me,
mm-hmm.
So that to make sure that I do better work, right?
Yeah, because if you bring in better people, then you have to raise and do better. And
or just yeah. different perspective, right? Because that's the thing. You're, you know, someone's going to see the problem in a different way,
mm-hmm.
right? It's kind of what you were saying too. It's like you do La Bohème, right? And you know, if my assistant director is female, then I have that voice. And in terms of thinking about the relationship first, right? If my instinct is going to be, you know, the plight of the Bohemians, and her perspective is going to be, you know, this relationship, then it's I'm only telling a better story if I can incorporate and listen and keep those perspectives there right. to keep it richer, right?
Now, the Long Beach Playhouse, I've worked there for a number of years, and they're very conscious of all that too. They mm-hmm. hire a very diverse cast of people. They've done a lot of shifting on shows so that Ophemera did a show not long ago. It was Importance of Being Earnest. Mm. Her entire cast was female.
Mm.
So even the two main lead guys were played by females in pants, and the two main lead girls were played by girls. And the whole thing was still played the same, except now we have girls and girls instead of boys and girls. And it was a very interesting look at it, because still the guys were written with more of a with a very different style than the girls were written, but they were still both played by females.
Yeah.
Or
but in pants role, because they didn't change the gender, they just made them a pants role. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, they still wore pants, they didn't wear dresses, but they still were, but they never said, like in the show, it never said you're male or you're female. They're mostly just playing on names. So it was a very interesting take on how that worked with everybody being female, but still being male without, yeah. you know, because we assume they're very different. But
we're taking on that dominant role.
Yeah, exactly. They also did another show that Sean Gray did that was A Midsummer Night's Dream, but he called it A Midsummer Night's Gay Dream. And he had a male and a female for one of the love interests, but then it was a male and a male for the other love interest. And so the juxtaposition of that on, you know, is their love being denied because one is male and the other one is male? Or is it because of the different class? Or is it because of the different gender? You know, I don't remember what race they were. But it was a very different take on the exact same story, but now we cast a male and a female role.
Mm-hmm.
But still did the whole love scene stuff. So it was very interesting to see how a play could be a very different version, whether you just simply switch a race or a gender, like you were saying.
Now I want to come back to that because that's a whole tangent. But before we kind of go away from this, I want to come back to, what do you feel you have experience resistance as a technical director?
As a female?
As a female.
Yeah. Absolutely. Not so, it's more of I have to prove myself every place I go. When I first started at a little theater in Fullerton, it was The Hunger Artist. I'm not sure if they're there anymore. And I walked in and I don't even think I was the TD. I was the stage manager for a show. And this was a little, not even 99 seat. I think they had like 30 seat storefront theater. And I knew the director. That's why I was there. But I'd never been to this little theater. I didn't know any of the guys. They brought in Andrew Vonderschmidt from the Long Beach Playhouse, which is how I got to the Playhouse. And he came in with the set. And they needed this set to have a window cut out of it in this pre-made flat. And I said, oh, okay, here I have tools. And they're like, you have tools? I was like, yeah, I have an entire tool bag in the back of my car. My dad bought it for me. has my name labeled on it. He was very excited. And they're like, okay. And then they're like, well, how are we going to cut a hole in this? I said, well, with a circular saw, we'll just drop it in here and cut straight and go over. And the five males standing around me were like, but what if you hit a staple? And I said, well, then it sparks. But the saw's going to go through a little staple. And so they're like, well, who wants to do it? And I was like, well, I'll do it. And they all stood there and watched me do it. And they were all like surprised that I owned tools and that I knew how to do this. And then after that, I used a screw gun. And then they were all like, oh, okay. She knows what she's doing. But I have to do that almost every place I go. And still a number of times when I get new crew members at the Norris, even though I'm the production manager and assistant technical director, and the guys who have been there with me know, a new guy will come in, he'll be like, do you need me to carry that? Nope, I can carry this flat. You'll figure it out. I know what I'm doing. But it's still, and I don't think most of them mean it.
Yeah.
they're just trying to be polite. Mm-hmm. And I don't take it as they're insulting me. It's just, like you said, subconscious. Yeah. That, you know, I'm a female. I can't carry as heavy things. It's true. I can't flip from carrying it like down by my waist to up by my shoulder. Like, I've got no upper body strength. And I know that. And I'll be like, hey, you boy, come over here. You have upper body strength. You know, you can do this. But I still have to be like, nope, I still know what I'm doing, even if I'm female.
You know, I've had a number of really interesting conversations with my master electrician, who's female. And we've talked about things where, like, you know, we'll bring in over hire crew, we'll encounter some folks who she'll notice they'll come to ask me questions.
Because you're male. Yeah.
And it's like not even like they realize it, right? And I'm like at the computer trying to run a budget, and they're coming in to ask me, and I'm like, go ask her. You know?
Yeah.
But it is kind of a thing where it's like when we recognize things, and it's always kind of thing, well, okay, what is the helpful thing to do, right? It's like because I don't, like, as the supervisor, it's like, do I confront this person and tell them, you know, go talk to her? Or is that like undoing her power because she is the supervisor of that crew and she needs to assert herself? So it's like, how do I support her in asserting her authority in that situation, you know?
Yeah.
Rather than forcing you to listen to her, right? It's always, there's an interesting, and it's like a case by case basis almost.
Yeah.
Which is frustrating, and I totally empathize with, you know, but I don't necessarily know what the right answer is.
Yeah, I don't know if there is a right answer.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, some people, almost all of my crew is male. Mm. My sound people, I have two sound people, and they're female. And Sarah Nishida used to be my master electrician, mm-hmm. and she's female. But Sarah definitely is assertive enough to make sure everyone knows that she was the one in charge of lights. And I'm always like, I don't know what lights is doing. Like, go talk to Sarah. Mm. She has it all planned out. But still, some people will talk to Steve Hicks, my master carpenter. And it's just because he's the one they know, because he's on deck and he's male. And I don't take it as offensive. I'm like, well, great. He's my master carpenter. Like, he's my first-hand person. He should know what's going on, too. Yeah. But oftentimes, he'll be like, I don't know, go talk to Stacy. Like, that's her job to figure out. Yeah, and I just think, I mean, I do it, too. If there's a group of people in the room, the person standing there with a cup of coffee who's usually male is probably the one in charge. So he's probably the one I'm going to go to first because, first of all, he's male, so he's probably the lead tech. And he's standing there with a cup of coffee, so he probably knows what's going on. And I'm not sure if it's a conscious thing or not. It's just that usually males are the techs and females aren't the ones in charge. So,
although, I mean, interestingly enough, I mean, I feel like we're at a point in this industry where, like, stage managers are predominantly women.
Yeah, we were talking about that. There's a lot more female stage managers, but I've never met another female TD.
Yeah. Mm.
They're almost always male.
Mm. Well, like, yeah. The only place where males are still the dominant role in stage management is on Broadway.
Oh, really?
Mm. Yeah, but everywhere else in the industry, it's predominantly female. Mm. But on Broadway, there's still very, very few female stage managers. And if there are, they're usually assistant stage managers and not the leads. So, but yeah, I've mostly worked with female stage managers. I've mostly hired female stage managers. Sometimes it's male. Actually, when I was just in Boston, when I was interviewing and was hired, their director of production made a point to say to hire only female stage managers because it was a new work and it was the composer and librettist were older white men and the director was an older white male and the scenic designer was an older white male and the costume, no costume was female. But wigs and makeup. So like the entire team, oh, and the conductor were all older white men. And so she insisted on hiring female stage managers just to make sure that there was balance in the room. Because she was like, I'm not working. And she was a female and we had a female technical director and a female. Well, we had two master electricians, but one was a female. And she insisted on hiring a female assistant director. Because she's like, we're not doing this new production with all, you know, middle-aged white men. That's just not going to happen. We need some balance in the room. And so she was very cautious about it. But probably because she is a female who was a TD, became a production manager. Yeah. But there are a lot more female stage managers than male stage managers now.
Yeah, Chris Gilbert, producer at the Norris right now, he's very conscious of it too. And I think some of it is because his wife is a very strong female director. Mm-hmm. And he's very conscious of when we hire people that we don't hire all white males. He's a white male, but he's like, I love it that our lighting designer is female and our TD is female. And so I'm going to hire, even though I'm hiring a male director, Orestes is, I think, Greek, mm-hmm. like first generation Greek. So he's like, I want to have diversity and I want to hire people that are not white 40-year-old males. And even when we're choosing shows, he's like, I want to choose shows that aren't just white male. I want to do different things and I want to hire people who have different backgrounds.
I mean, that's, yeah, so that's kind of going back to like that idea of color consciousness, right?
Yeah.
Color conscious casting and intentionality towards diversity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, it's just good business.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, because it is. Like, if you're not developing the audience, then you're shutting your own theater down, honestly. You're making yourself more dependent on the grants.
Exactly. And if you don't have a big
grant
writer.
Which nobody knows how to write, because nobody would
have to write. Yeah, see? It's a big circle. Yeah, exactly. So I think that's why when I've wanted to see Allegiance since we first heard about it, when Kai and I first heard about it, but we couldn't get down to San Diego. And then we heard it was going to Broadway, and so we planned a visit to go visit Cindy, and it closed the week before we made it out to New York to visit Cindy. I was like, God damn it. And so when Andy called me, he's like, hey, do you want to do Allegiance? I said, yes. Okay, when's the show? But I was like, oh, thank God. We've been wanting to see the show. Now I get to work on this show, and I've heard so much about East-West Players, and we love Little Tokyo and Japan and all, that I was like, yes, this is like a dream come true. I get to work on this show that I've always wanted to see, and the music's great, and I get to, like, I don't know how I have not eaten Japanese food every day, but I do stop and get a milk tea or something every time I'm up there. And we do have plans when Kai comes to do a full Japanese dinner while up there. And I'm trying to get Cindy out for the show. And even though she's vegetarian, we can still do Japanese food. She's had to suffer through a couple of things.
I don't know. You tried poisoning me when we had pho.
Yeah, I forgot it was pork based.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, it's just broth and noodles and vegetables. Really great. No. Oops.
No.
Messed that one up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember trying to explain vegetarian to my mom. And you think, like, you know, Chinese people have, like, you know, Buddhist monks and stuff that are like vegetarian. It's like, but like for my mom, it was like, oh, it's a little bit. It's just broth. No,
it's got chicken and pork in it.
That's the little bit is not vegetarian.
Exactly. Like, well, you can still eat fish and chicken. It's like, well, some vegetarians eat fish, but it's still not really vegetarian if you're still eating meat. So yeah. But yeah.
Well, our southern grandma used to get excited, you know. She would tell me, she's like, Cindy, I knew you were coming, so I was really careful and I made some a salad and some beans. And I said, great, what's in the salad? And there was like chicken in the salad. And of course, you know, the beans that she made had a bunch of bacon in it. But in her head, she like made salad and beans for me because I'm vegetarian and didn't even think about the fact that she put meat in them.
Yeah, because it's just normal. And of course, the gravy is all made with actual meat sauce, like actual, she took the fat off the meat and mixed it in, and that's, you know, the gravy. It's like, oh, Twin can't have gravy on her potatoes now.
She's going to have bacon. It's both meat and condiment.
Yeah, it goes on everything. Twin's really missing out on her lack of bacon. We eat enough over here to balance out. But yeah, it's like you said, it's just different people not understanding or different cultures or whatever. I mean, vegetarian isn't really new, and it's not like a white thing, but definitely you go to different countries and they're like, I don't understand what a vegetarian is.
Well, so going back to what we were talking before, talking about like consciously like looking at works within our kind of current cultural lens, right? Mm-hmm. I actually an oft collaborator of mine, Jane Louie, YouTube artist, singer, songwriter, composer. We've been talking on and off about this idea of doing Stephen Sondheim's company, right?
Oh yeah.
But gender bending the crap out of it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Why does the lead guy have to be a male? who has an issue with relationships.
And honestly, just when you look at kind of how we're looking at relationships now, right? In kind of our current context, right? For Bobby to be female, right? And then like looking at like the three relationships under that lens, you know, where, you know, like, you know, the flight attendant is now male, or, you know, or if you decide that I can't remember all the characters, but the
I just know the music. I've never actually seen the show.
Well, you know, because it's all these different married couples talking about marriage, mm-hmm. and talking about, you know, relationships and whatever.
And Bobby's friends with all of them, but doesn't ever get that marriage.
Yeah, and he has that. Like, you know, he's a chronic dater. You know, he has various relationships of various significance or not, and you know, has to decide kind of what the idea of marriage means for him. Right, mm-hmm. as a chronically single person, and yeah, it was just like the conversations around it of you know, is like one of the couples now an aging gay couple, gay male couple, is one of the other couples, you know, still a, you know, cisnormative couple, and you know, but then that dynamic of, you know, Bobby, you gotta, you know, settle down soon type thing. Like, it changes, right? Because mm-hmm. then it becomes about all these. So, you know, and just the ideas that were coming out as we were spitballing, you know, a show that we both love, and all the new interesting, like, depth and texture that was coming up just from trying to look at the same story through a different lens. You know, that's basically what we've been doing with Shakespeare for, you know, the last, you know, 50-100 years, right? You know, because otherwise, you know, Romeo and Juliet, it's really boring. But then if you put
that show
on the West Side in the 1960s, suddenly there's dancing and it's about, you know,
same story, completely different idea.
Exactly, right?
And brought in race and all that.
Right. Or if so there's something to that, right? There's something about finding what's the universal idea in the story and how it fits within our time, and therefore becomes more relevant to us.
Yeah, I think also going with the male versus female or different races, mm-hmm. or anything like that, the gay mm-hmm. community has and trans and are also rising a lot in mm-hmm. society and culture, and just becoming more accepted. I mean, they're not new. It's not like being gay is a new idea, but just getting out there and having gay couples on TV, or the whole, is it legal or right for gay people to get married and how all of that works, I think is also a big thing that's growing in the theater world, because the theater, we've often been okay with that. Theater people in general,
internally.
Exactly.
We've been okay with that. Externally.
Yeah, we don't show it as much, but internally, it's fairly well known that there's quite a few gay people in the theater. And I feel like theater people, at least most of the ones I know, it's not a big deal. Mm-hmm. And we don't see it as an issue. But then you look at the outside world, and it is a big issue and a big deal. And they're not accepted everywhere. Instead of just playing with race and male and female, but playing with what is male or female? And is male just a guy with a dick? Or is it a girl who is very powerful in that and sees herself more masculine and all that? And is it just one or two things?
You know, actually, I just saw a really amazing play last night, actually. It's at Skylight Theater. They're closing this weekend, unfortunately, so I'm not shouting them out. But
it's always good to talk about new theater.
But the play was called Rotterdam. It's at the Skylight Theater over on, like, near Los Feliz, I want to say. And it was kind of revolving around four people, four character play. And you had the lesbian couple, one of them who has not come out to her family yet and is still adjusting to being a lesbian, living as a lesbian. Then you have her girlfriend, who at the same time is recognizing that she is transgender and is about to start transitioning to being male. And then you have her/his brother, who's actually the ex-boyfriend of the girlfriend. So he already dealt with her transitioning from thinking she was heterosexual to being gay and dating his sister.
And now his sister is becoming his brother.
His brother. And then you have like the other female gay love interest who's, you know, tempting to the main character, right? But it's this whole thing where it's like, well, as the girlfriend transitions to becoming male, what does this mean for her?
Yeah, right? Because are you still a lesbian if you're now technically involved with a male that used to be a female?
Right. And it's like the love is still there because I'm in love with this person, with this persona, but I identify myself as a lesbian, and now you're talking about having a penis, and the person one of the lines was like, as you change, I'm watching you kill the person that I love, right? So that you can become this other thing. It was really just fascinating. Wonderful play. And of course, that's juxtaposed with her ex-boyfriend, who had to watch her transition from being his girlfriend to being a lesbian.
Yeah, to be a very interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
What was the name of the play?
It's called Rotterdam. So that was the other thing, too. There was some amazing accent work. If they're listening, you guys did great. yeah, so it's like three British characters who are in Rotterdam, which is in Finland?
Really? I don't know.
So you have three English accents and one Danish accent, I think. And all, you know, local LA actors.
Which is also different, because what is it like living in a different country?
Right.
Well, how that country or the country you come from accept different genders and that whole transition.
Well, they actually were kind of using that as kind of an allegory, because it's like they are removed from their home worlds where their families are.
Uh-huh.
There's also a recurring theme in terms of they celebrate King's Day there, but before it was King's Day, it was Queen's Day, right? So at what point do you go, well, we're celebrating King's Day. Do we like it less? Do we like it more? Does it change what the holiday really is?
Yeah, right? Does it matter?
So that was kind of a recurring kind of undercurrent to kind of push some of the themes of the play. It was really, really wonderful. And, you know, for anyone who has dealt with breakup, it was like very triggering.
It's very interesting. But, yeah. It sounds like a good one.
It was great. Yeah, it was a really good play.
Obviously, probably more of a new work than an older piece.
Probably, yeah. Yeah. I don't know the history of it. But kind of talking about some of these issues too, right? I mean, like, honestly, like, the whole transgender thing is something that's like, there's a situation where, like, I know I'm going to get it wrong. And I'm really dependent on a couple of close friends, you know, who are either transitioned or deciding or deciding to not decide, whatever like that, right?
Yeah.
I value that. I mean, it's unfortunate that like they must take the onus of I have to learn from them.
Yeah, but I think like my best friend is gay, and growing up, we didn't consciously know any gay people. I mean, maybe we did. I don't know. But color, like, we lived in a pretty white city, but our neighbors who were our best friends were of Mexican descent, and another one of our best friends, Sarah, had Spanish in her, and so like we didn't. And my dad's best friend is African American. And so we didn't really, it wasn't like, oh, we only had white friends. So we didn't really understand it when people were like, you know, oh my God, there's Asians. And we're like, yeah, that's just what happens. So now that my best friend is gay, we didn't have that growing up. And so when he would say things and I'd be like, what are you talking about? Like, I remember one time he was like, yeah, we were at the gym and this guy and his dad were there. And I was like, oh, that's cool. And, you know, he's hanging out with his dad. And he's like, that's not what I mean by dad. And I was like, what do you mean by dad if not dad? He's like daddy. And I was like, so father, I don't understand. He's like, no, like an older male who is living with this younger female and is being the father figure. And I was like, oh, very different context of what I was thinking. But it's just a different culture or a different way that they, different slang words and all that I was never, knew nothing about. So I'm constantly like, okay, you have to explain that one to me. I don't know what you're talking about. Or so, like, how was it coming out? Because I've always known him as gay. But obviously, at some point, unfortunately, the gay community has to say, like, I'm gay. And the straight people don't have to be like, hey, guess what? I'm straight. And so just, like, how was that process? Like, who did you tell? Or how did you figure it out? Or how did your parents react? Or how did that change your perspective on things? And it's interesting on how just everyone's different and how that works. Because I haven't had to do that.
Well, you know, so this is, okay, and this is where I, like, once again, take disparate skill sets and apply them, mm-hmm. right? If you've at all, like ever like trained in martial arts, or if you like, you know, are a Bruce Lee fan, right? Bruce Lee invented his fighting style, Jeet Kune Do, kind of based on this idea of he felt martial arts styles were getting so locked into tradition that they were ineffective, right? It's like you get locked into doing a form, you get locked into style, then you can't adapt to the moment.
So you can only fight certain people who are fighting that same style.
That, or you will only fight in a certain way, which therefore, like, you know, someone comes in with a new move and it's like it's you don't know how to react to it, right? So his whole idea of the ultimate fighter was someone who was formless. You know, that's the whole thing of be like water. You know, water pours into a cup, it becomes the cup. Water pours into a pot, becomes the pot, right? But water is soft and you can punch it and it will go around you. But water can carve out the Grand Canyon and whatever. So it's the idea of being formless and abandoning this idea of style, or abandoning the idea of being locked into something, right? So that's, in many ways, I think it was like, that's the powerful thing, right? If you can put yourself into life, into situations, and be able to adapt to your surroundings, to be open-minded enough to go, you know, I'm eating sushi today, or I, you know, I should not put my chopsticks into the rice and make it look like, you know, an omen of death. Or I'm eating Ethiopian food and I'm now eating with my hands and, you know, utilizing the bread. But mm-hmm. It is that ability to adapt, which is powerful, right? And that's because that's how you are able to keep your mind open and not get locked into one way of doing things or one perspective, right?
Yeah, the food thing is, yeah, a great example. Mm-hmm. We've grew up in Southern California. We eat a lot of Mexican food.
Yeah.
When we studied in London, Cindy and I, for a couple months, we learned about Indian food. Mm-hmm. And we love Indian food now, but we just didn't have it in Southern California. And it's still kind of hard to find everywhere. And then I met Kai, and he's like, you got to eat this Japanese food. And I'm like, great, perfect. And I learned how to use chopsticks while in Hawaii. But yeah, it's a very different form. Like, chopsticks are very different than a fork and knife. Well, but it's not one's wrong or one's right.
But just thinking in terms of, you know, your experience, right? I mean, the ability to adapt, uh-huh. how powerful that is, and what you've learned just from being able to constantly change things up, mm-hmm. and adapt to the room, adapt to the cuisine, adapt to, you know, the way of thinking.
The culture, you know, and everything.
Because it forces your mind to think a new way. And suddenly you have new synapses building because, I mean, I remember the first time I put on VR goggles, right? Put on VR goggles. And I'm drawing, I'm painting in three dimensions. And I seriously just felt my brain explode with all these synapses. I've never had to think, like, if I'm painting in surfaces, then I have to paint in a circle if I want. Because if I can draw a circle, but it's just going to be a flat disc and it's not. If I want a circle, then I need to draw in a ball, right? And suddenly it was like, it was you know, just the way of having to get my brain to not get locked into thinking of this is a circle, this is only a circle. Mm-hmm. Versus I now have to think in three dimensions, right?
Yeah,
that's what it is. It's the formlessness. And so that's what I, when we talk about like, you know, these conversations about diversity, it's like, it's not about, you know, I mean, yes, there's intentionality, there's color consciousness, there's whatever, but it is about learning to kind of to listen more and open your mind to keep things open so that you can still discover. If you can't discover, then you've locked into a thing and you can't learn new things.
Yeah. If you just think, you know, I'm white, so the whole world works like me. It's like, no, a lot of the world doesn't work like that. And then, yeah, it also builds boundaries is maybe the wrong word. It builds, I guess, walls between people. Mm-hmm. If I'm not willing to be like, hey, look, Andy's not white. I can't be friends with Andy. He's not white like I am. He's also male. I really can't be friends with that. Then that seems like a very small world you live in, and a lot of disliking people. I'm like, great, a new person.
Well, or limiting, even if it's not something as simple as, you know, I hate this type of person. If it's just something where this is how I see the world and this is how it works. It's like, well, actually, we've got many of other countries where that's not how it works, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, just the, you know, just looking at trends in design, right? You know, and just how much, you know, we as a culture, as an American culture, have learned by amalgamating, you know, various design ideas, whether it's kind of Art Nouveau or kind of European, you know, Renaissance, or, you know, Chinese design. I mean, you know, you look at like Frank Lloyd Wright, and he was very much about adapting to the environment, and you can kind of see like a lot of his influence and how he sees shape in terms of inhabiting spaces is very influenced by Japanese. Mm-hmm. You can see those harsh angles that kind of mold to the surroundings, and it's like it's very Japanese and infused, but it's certainly still coming from a Western European lens.
Still, right? Very European, yeah. But also it blends in with the trees that are there, or mm-hmm. the waterfall that's there, or the rocks that it's built on. Huh, never thought about it as more of Japanese. Like Cindy, you've been to a couple of his houses.
Yeah, a couple of them. I've been to his house in Chicago, where he lived for 20 years and grew his family. And then there's a number of houses in Chicago. And then last year, Matt and I went to the Running Water one outside of Pittsburgh, which was really awesome. Going to his house was cool because it was more of an education about him as a person and how his designs grew as he got older, you know, because the house he bought, like just a normal house, and he kept adding on to it. So you kind of saw room to room, like how he grew as an architect and as a designer. And then, of course, you know, Falling Waters is one of his most iconic ones, but that was so much later in his life. It's just completely different style. Mm. But sorry, I'm starting to fade.
it is late on your side. And we've been talking for almost 2 hours.
Oh my God, seriously?
Yeah. See, people are always like, oh, I don't have anything to say. And at first we were like, okay, we'll do like 30-minute interviews. And after our second interview, we're like, nope, these are like hour-long interviews.
Oh, no, I know, I'm a director. I can talk forever. I mean, it was more so I just wasn't sure what direction you wanted to go with things. Yeah. You wanted to keep things focused. I was like, no. I know we've kind of, I mean, like, shoot, man. I just quoted Bruce Lee. I mean,
Walt Disney, and we started in San Diego, and now we've talked about Andrew Lloyd Wright. Yeah. And people are like, well, what do you ask? And we say, so why are you in theater? And usually for an hour, it just goes, and who knows where we're going to end up. But I think that's the great part, like, because no two people have the same story. No two people came into theater or do theater or have a view on theater exactly the same. I mean, which is also one of the things with being twins, nature versus nurture. We're identical twins, but obviously we don't do everything exactly the same. Mm-hmm. She's a stage manager, I'm a TD, but we do have a lot of crossover because we grew up together. She knows how to build a set and I know how to run a show or call a show. But it's still, you know, she went to grad school, I didn't. She became an SM, I didn't. She went to New York, I didn't. There's a lot of differences, but a lot of similarities. So that was one of the reasons we wanted to talk to other people, to be like, so how did you get into theater? What do you do in theater? Like, how did this start? And then what do you do now? So I guess that leads to the final question. So Twin can go to sleep. The final question that we always ask everyone, being twins, is, do you have any twin stories? Any twins you've worked with? Any confusion on twins? Anything related to twins?
Well, I mean,
I know, I should really get people warnings. Well, so they can think of something.
I warn people in advance. Stacey just like throws it at them.
Just like, hey, Andy, you want to be on an interview in like 3 days?
Great. Sure. I mean, okay, like actual twins stories or like theater twins? I played the evil doppelganger of the Monkey King. I can say my high school crush was a twin.
Nice. Did you get your crush confused with the twin?
I never did.
Were they identical or fraternal?
They were identical, but I mean, the girl that I had the crush on, I don't know, she was just very distinct to me.
Huh.
Also, I mean, I think like her sister was a little bit more athletically inclined, so she was like the type that was like wanted to join the wrestling team and whatever, and then she was kind of the more like intellectually inclined, although she was still in the track. I mean, shoot, dude, I joined the track team to hang out with her because it was lame. I also failed Spanish because of her.
Damn her.
Ah, sorry. No, it's not funny, actually. She came, actually, I saw her the first time since high school. A couple of years back, she came and saw one of our musicals. And it was like...
Did she know you were there or part of it or anything?
Oh, you know, I invited her. Or, like, she had seen one of my posts. She's like, oh, I totally want to see them. It's like, well, I'll give you a copy if you want to come.
Nice. And thank you, Facebook, for connecting everybody for years.
But it was, yeah, it was totally, like, I mean... Like, I held it together, like, externally, but, like, internally, I was like... I'm failing Spanish all over again. Wow, this is the funniest sense memory. Like, totally just like, you know, I'm like, I'm in my 40s now.
I'm not taking Spanish.
It's like, it's like 20 years ago. But I'm like, here I am standing like, you know, 5 feet away from you. I'm like, oh, I'm getting butterflies.
That's excellent.
You know, she has a great husband and these beautiful kids. It's like, whatever. But it's just the funniest thing where I'm like,
yeah, wow. Sensory reaction.
Yeah, yeah.
So then you played a twin. How much did you go into being a twin? Because people always ask us, what's it like being a twin? And we're like, we don't know. What's it like being a singleton? So how did you go from being a singleton to playing a twin? Did that come into developing a character, knowing that you...
Yeah, well, you know, because, I mean, the trick with that... Okay, so this is a famous story one of the most popular, like, pieces of children's literature in Asia is The Journey to the West. And it's a story of a Tang Dynasty a monk who travels from, you know, China to India to bring the teachings of Buddha back to China. And he's, you know, kind of in the tradition of like kind of like old like Tolkien or like all these other kind of great epic stories, or, you know, Iliad, is that he has three disciples who are, you know, have various powers, but are still kind of fallen heroes that are seeking redemption. So this is their journey to the West is as much about their redemption as it is about bringing the teachings of Buddha to China. And so he has like a half pig, half man, a character. You have a former cannibal kind of demon spirit who's with them. And then you have the king of the monkeys, right? So Monkey King is like a very popular character. So for years, the guy who was my Kung Fu instructor had actually been playing the Monkey King for this company called Asian Story Theater in San Diego. And I ended up being cast for when we got to the story. There's like 99 different stories in this tale.
Yeah, big saga.
Of different challenges that they must confront before making it to India. And one of the challenges famously is the real and the fake Monkey King. So basically I had to play my Kung Fu instructor's doppelganger. So a lot of that too just comes from, you know, he's my Kung Fu teacher. So like I know how he moves. And so in terms of emulating his movement, and not just his movement, but his particularly his monkey style Kung Fu, you know, I mean, I spent God years with him in you know, training with him. So like, you know, you emulate his movement and it's like, so that certainly helped that I had a kind of a head start in that.
Yeah.
But also kind of developed, you know, trying to mimic his voice and his, you know, his characterization so that it would be like, okay, so I'm the evil doppelganger. I'm, you know, pretending to be him and, you know, the other characters can't figure out which one is the real and the fake and which one is the good and the evil one. So I was like, so does that answer? I don't know.
So you were really the evil twin.
Yes. Yes.
Did he do anything to try to emulate you or to do anything to kind of balance you? Or are you completely just trying to balance
him? Well, I think it was totally me just doing my best impersonation of what he had been doing. And it's funny because he actually, you know, he was not really an actor. He was a Kung Fu teacher and elementary school counselor and jazz musician.
How did he get into acting on this epic play?
Because the director basically was like looking for a martial artist to play Monkey King, because the Monkey King is really important and he's got a lot of fights and he's a very beloved character. And he was kind of the one who really understood kind of that monkey kung fu, and also had a natural kind of, you know, theatricality to him, right? So when he got the role, he actually spent more time working on his monkey style. He like spent a lot of time actually in the zoo mimicking monkeys. So and that's where all of this like this character voice, you know, I mean, he had this, it's funny, it's like it was one part basically monkeys in the zoo and one part Bugs Bunny, because right? he's a trickster kind of character. So he, like, he had his voice and he's like, I'm in here. it's like and he had this like monkey laugh and monkey noises that were like based on what he was doing. And he literally was like sit there with the monkeys and he would mimic and the monkeys would freak out at him and he would like, you know,
play with the monkeys.
Right. Yeah. I mean, just through the window and just kind of mimic, and they would like see he was mimicking and they'd be kind of confused and you know, using his kung fu training as kind of the basis for that. And then of course for me it was just kind of learning to mimic him, because, you know, picking up his vocal things and kind of what are the choices he's doing. And it was that was actually the very very funny thing as we're going through the rehearsal process, because, you know, after years of training with him and also seeing them like this, the various productions they had done of this from the other stories, it's like it was very funny both for me, for him, and for the other actors and the director to just have for me to mimic him in that way, and just to have this, because also then it becomes the mirror thing of like, really, do I sound like that? Oh my god.
So did you start? You started picking up his mannerisms and stuff outside of that.
What happened was that so we did that production, and then I started taking on some of the Monkey King roles for some of the other, like the, we had like the big show that we would do at the Lyceum, which would be like, you know, 8-person cast or whatever like that, and then we would have smaller shows that would travel to schools. So I ended up being the one to do the Monkey King when we would travel to schools.
Because you already knew,
the character, and how the character all and all that. Well, what happened is that then, like after time away, my monkey started to morph a little bit and start to take on elements of my personality. So then it would diverge a little bit. So I had a little bit more of a wilier psycho monkey. And he had the more kind of grounded, like stern warrior monkey.
And the kids probably liked either one.
They did. It was, you know, but it was, yeah, it is kind of interesting to kind of, you know, using him as the starting point, you know, and it was very fun to do all that kind of call response and mimicking to start with. But not exactly a twin story. But.
Yeah, but you were playing a twin. Most people don't play twins. Not everyone is a twin. Mm-hmm. We understand. So you have any other questions, Twin? I think we covered quite a bit.
Can I sleep now?
Yeah.
I think because it's snowing, so I'm hibernating now.
Oh, there's that.
I'm wearing short sleeves.
Well, it's warm in here. It's just it's snowing and, you know,
outside of hibernation.
Yes.
Yeah, outside of my room.
Light deprivation.
Thanks so much for joining us. Hopefully, I'll see you in February. Is that when you want me to come out?
Yeah. Right? So Allegiance the Musical. Starts previews February 21st or February 22nd, I think.
Yeah, and the official big opening is February 28th.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping to get Twin out to be with me at the whole red carpet big show.
Actually,
big
thing. First preview, I think, actually is also significant. It's February 22nd is actually the Day of Remembrance, which was when people were actually sent to the camps. So
Twin, we have some play on when we fly you out here.
Well, I mean, the whole to-do, the opening night will be, whatever it is, the 28th. Or is it the 1st? It might be the 1st, actually. Is it the 1st?
I thought it was the 28th.
You might be right.
Or, of course, I think Loden
good is, production manager!
I know Loden is January 28th.
Yeah.
So, that's okay,
we'll
the first one in my head.
We'll double check this before I buy my tickets. I don't come, like, the weekend early. That would suck. But.
Yeah. Like, well, you still get to see the show, just none of the fun big party stuff.
True. Yeah.
And still running till April 1st. So.
Yeah. So we still have time. I plan to see it a couple of times. I've told Mom and Dad they're coming. I told Rusty he's coming. Larry and Fee and all the people we play D&D with, I told them they're coming. So we got people coming.
Okay, good. Well, thanks that. For joining us, Andy, and thanks for the awesome conversation. Yeah. It's
thank you for having
so
me.
So cool to hear everybody's different perspectives on theater, and yeah, I'm just excited to see where theater goes in the next 30 years.
Yeah,
but
yeah, it's gonna be an interesting time to see as it morphs.
Good changes.
Well, and we'll have to morph, right? I mean, because the funding models will change.
Yeah, the audience, the traditional audience theater audience is dying out because we're not all old white people who can afford the big monies. So yeah, it'll be great. And we'll be right there pushing non-white roles all the time. Excellent.
Absolutely.
Okay,
thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Twins Talk Theater. If you would like more, please visit our website at twinstalktheater.podbean.com or on Facebook at Twins Talk Theater. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Google Play Music. Also, give us a review on iTunes and tell us what you liked about the show.